guys, and welcome to episode 180 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now, in this episode, I got on Dr. Charles Mansueto. Charles is founder and director of Behavior Therapy Center of Greater Washington, and he's also on the Scientific and Clinical Advisory Board of the ISDF. So it was great to get him on. Several people have asked for him to be on the show, so it was great to finally get him on and chat with him all about his experience in treating OCD. And he also goes into kind of the history of how OCD therapy has developed, which was really fascinating. He talks about when he was consulting on the TV show Pure, which is Rose Cartwright's TV show. So he was, him and Professor David Veal were advising Rose and the TV production team, making sure they did a good job and did right by everyone who has OCD and by the diagnosis. So that was interesting. Then we talked about general ERP stuff, you know, explaining ERP, sticking points. We talked about OCD and Tourette's and also Tourette's OCD. We talked about uncertainty and his views around that. And then what he notices from his clients that seem to recover quicker than others. And he gives a lot of client examples, which I found fascinating and really illustrated his point. So I think you're really going to enjoy that. And then the usual questions towards the end. So thank you to Charles. It was great talking to him and an honor to speak to him for the hour. But yeah, without further ado, here is Dr. Charles Mansueto.
On the podcast today, I have Dr. Charles Mansueto. Charles is the founder and director of Behavior Therapy Center of Greater Washington, and he currently serves on the Scientific and Clinical Advisory Board for the ISDF. Welcome to the show, Charles.
Well, thank you, Stuart. I'm happy to be here.
It's good to have you here. So what I'd love to know is why you got into being a therapist generally, and then also why specifically OCD?
Wow. Okay. That's important because it's my life. So it's really the story of my life, much of it. But way back in college days, I went to a university called Rutgers University. And the first college course I had in psychology, general psych, I remember very distinctly a professor mentioned, he said, now all of you have read the chapter on disorders, on abnormal psychology. We all nodded. And you know the difference between psychosis and neurosis. You know, these are the old terms for neurosis being problems of living, psychosis being sort of crazy stuff, you know, more severe disorders like schizophrenia. And so, yeah, we all nodded. If you had to have one, neurosis, right? Yes, yes, yes. And they said, well, wait a second. He said, we have professors and students and groundskeepers and cafeteria personnel who are psychotic. But we have very good medications that control various forms of psychoses, particularly schizophrenia. He said, but one neurosis, OCD, he said, we have no treatment. We have no medication. We have no psychology, no psychological treatment that is thought to work. Even Freud never believed that psychoanalysis was powerful enough to correct what he called obsessional neurosis. Well, that's stuck in my mind, and so I guess it bothered me. And so, why that? Why one thing? You know, and so I did papers on it whenever I could and for different courses, and went through my graduate school focused on CBT because that seemed to be the area that had some promise for that. And when I became a university professor, I had an opportunity to take a year off to study anywhere I wanted. I had a grant to study, and I went to Temple University. Now, Temple in the U.S. was the first place that there was research and treatment for OCD. Many people went there who are now well known in OCD, in the OCD world, because the person that used to be called the father of behavior therapy, and behavior therapy was the name before CBT, so I'm an oldie, so I go back a ways, right? And went there to study with him. His name was Joseph Wolpe. One of the people who went there was Edna Foa. Mm. Now, many of your audience will certainly know Edna Foa. She's like a goddess in the OCD world, and she should be with the things she did. I went there, and there I met not only Edna but other people at within the OCD realm. Gail Steckety was there, John Grayson was there, Alec Pollard was there. These are luminaries, so out of that group, we weren't the first ones, but we were early involved in OCD, and they invited me to stay on. Dr. Wolpe, Joseph Wolpe, asked me to start the Child and Family Program. Edna ran the adult program. And so I did. I stayed on for 5 years until they closed it down. It moved around. Now it's at the University of Pennsylvania, still with Edna at the head of it. So it's a long story. I hope I'm not
No,
boring you.
keep going.
But at the after Welpy retired, they closed that unit down, and it gave me an opportunity to come back to the Washington area full time. Well, just then there was a great interest at National Institute of Mental Health. Dr. Judith Rapoport was researching anafrenil, the first drug, first medication that was found to be useful for OCD, or thought to be useful for OCD. She confirmed that. But it didn't work for everyone, and she sent a few people over. One, a young man that was very severely impaired with OCD, but the medication didn't work, and his family was very upset. And of course, they were upset that there was no improvement. But she had heard that there was somebody in town that used a different approach, learning. So she sent this fellow over. I treated him for about, 3 months, 4 months. He did very well in treatment, and I brought him back there. And Dr. Rapoport said, "Daniel, what happened?" He said, "I learned a lot." And he was obviously freed up, and he was talking freely and moving freely and all the things he couldn't do before. So she asked me to write that up, and I did for a text that she was writing on OCD in children and adolescents. I wrote it as a case study. And she also included in The Boy Who Couldn't Stop Washing, which was a blockbuster book for OCD because it put it on the map among the general. It went to New York Times bestseller list, number 16. So all of a sudden, the world was aware of it. Now she said, "This is so exciting to see that learning can do this. I wonder if the brain changes that we see with our medication are also occurring with the learning." She said it was going to be this a neuropsychiatric study of the decade, and so that's what we did. We did a study with her that before they were treated, they imaged them using a PET scan, particle emission tomography, getting a picture of the living brain and what was going on with it. We would treat these folks for about a few months and send them back, and they would take the picture again. Sure enough, there were changes that were looked like normalization in the sense of brain function, a particular part of the brain, the caudate nucleus, that looked overactive in OCD, the one kind of objective stamp that OCD exists in the person, was corrected, and it no longer was able to. You were able to distinguish that person from someone who never had OCD. Well, that was an exciting occurrence. It really made NIMH in a number of departments, but certainly in OCD, take more notice. And since then, we worked very synergistically to see at how medical and psychological treatments can work together to produce the best possible effects. So that was the long story. Thank you for bearing with me. But then, of course, it was only a matter of time before more and more people realized that if medication was not sufficient, then there was this place. First, it was me. Now it's 20 people who work day in and day out with every variety of OCD and related problems.
No, thank you for that. I love hearing about where it all got started and the history.
I love having been there because
Yeah, I
it's been a
bet.
fascinating professional life, very rewarding, and even on a bad day, I go home and say we did good, or else we tried to do good things. So working with OCD is fascinating and rewarding, and that's why our clinic staff stays around and continues to work there.
No, that's awesome. Okay, so I've had Rose Cartwright on the podcast a couple of times now, and I know her personally. She's wonderful.
She's one.
Yeah, absolutely. And you wrote the afterword in her book, and also you consulted on the TV show. And you know, I had the privilege of seeing the screening in London when she before it went out on TV, and she was talking. She name dropped you along with David Veal, who is the guy in the UK. Yeah. And she gave credit to you guys of you know, your expertise helped keep the TV show realistic and not become cartoonized almost, as TV often does of OCD. So yeah, what was that like, that whole experience?
Well, it was quite an experience. First, I got a out of the blue, because here we are in the US and I get a message from England that they would like me to consider doing an afterword for this book that was written. And there was a little blurb on the YouTube that about the book, and Rose was on it. And you know Rose, she's a very pretty and vivacious person, and so it was a very catchy little blurb they put out, and I looked at it and I thought, it's mainly a sexual theme. This, you know, attractive person, it's going to be a little bit on the sensational side. I don't think so. So I wrote back and I said, no, and I gave a few names of people. I said I was awful busy, and I had other things, deadlines. So, well, they wrote back and said, no, we want you to do it. And I said, why is that? Well, it turned out that the publisher, his brother is in the U.S. He's a professor here, and I'm on the scientific advisory board. So she contacted him and said, of the psychologists you know, who would you like to write? Who do you think would do a decent job with this thing? So he told me. So they said, would you please read it? There was a second point that turned me away from it, and that was that most psychologists don't like the pure psychology label. It was a misnomer, really, for decades. The old way of thinking about OCD was that the O, the obsessions, were mental and the compulsions were physical. And that is a hard thing to break, that idea. And so when people profess to have pure OCD, almost always they had covert rituals or mental rituals, you know, like an example that comes to mind is one of my patients who feared in some way loving and being in league with the devil. And so that stirred her and upset her so much, because she wanted to be God loving and a decent person. And so she would have to stop and freeze until she got a clear picture of God's face smiling at her. And so she didn't have to move a muscle. She could be sitting in the chair and doing her ritual, right? And it was clearly a ritual. So there's been a redefinition of rituals as any voluntary action that reduces the distress or the or reduces the likelihood of a catastrophic outcome for that individual. And so we know that covert rituals are often misinterpreted as purely obsessional. So I said no to that too, but they said, please read it. And when I read it very early in the book, Rose said she knew the difference between, and she said she had predominantly covert or mental rituals, but she did have a number of other rituals to recognize the avoidance and the escape mechanism she would use, testing herself and other things that are very common. So I thought, and the second thing I realized was, she was very honest. It was a raw and personal and very revealing illustration of how awful OCD can be. And it usually is a little polished in professional text, even in first-person text. But Rose was willing to say it as it was. And I thought, wow, this is really good, because people are still very embarrassed about the nature of particularly sexual intrusive thoughts. So that changed my mind. As soon as I read the chapter, I said yes. And I said, they wanted 3 pages. I said, I would really like to use this as an opportunity to say more about than I can in 3 pages. And they said, well, see, we'll see what we do. So it came out, I don't know how many, 9 or 10, but I was able to talk about why people get stuck in these particular rituals, why it is so personally difficult, and also how treatment can sometimes miss the boat, and the mistakes that can be made both by the person who has the OCD, mistakes meaning that the things they're doing to try to get out of the discomfort are actually digging them deeper into the hole. You know how that is. Yeah. You know, that's what happens. That's what rituals do. They feel better momentarily, but they're worsening the problem over time. So anyway, I wrote that, and the book came out, and I was very pleased. A little nervous because my name now was with a book that was bound to be sensational, or perhaps sensationalized by the media. But it wasn't like that. The first thing that I saw the reports, and each time people seemed to respect Rose's dignity, honesty, and the legitimacy of what she was claiming. I didn't see anything that would argue that she's just selling books or trying to make it sexy and interesting. It wasn't that at all. And then a little bit later, so I that was fine. I was glad I did it. Came out, book looked good. Afterward, we worked together, and it said just what I wanted it to say. And then I heard they're now considering a TV show. Well, would I? The producers or the writers, I'm not sure who, but said the afterward enriched their understanding of the character. They felt it really, and they wondered whether I would be willing to be the reader. Now, originally, Rose brought me on. She didn't want to make any mistakes. Also, she wanted me to read it and see if her recommendations or the way she described her experiences were legitimate, or might she have gone off course in certain ways. Well, she was very accurate, but I did have a few suggestions. But now it was going to be in the hands of TV producers and writers and whatever. And I knew here, well, we're going to. Yeah, it has to be entertaining as well as informative. So I was a little nervous about that, but I said, sure, I'll give it a go. At this point in my career, I wasn't worried about if it was criticized and bombed. I didn't think my career was going to be too awfully affected. But I thought it was the right thing to do. And it turned out to be a remarkable experience because they did such a nice job, I thought, with the portraying it, and it did have humor, but it was never humor that was at the expense of either OCD or of the character of Rose. It was done very carefully, and when I did have suggestions, they tried very hard to follow it to the letter. Sometimes they had to remind me, wait, it has to be entertaining too, so we we're going to keep this in, but all in all, the experience was very positive, and I don't really know. I haven't followed it too closely. Whether the show is going to be continued, that was an interesting question. If the first, I think six was successful, they would see about doing a second one and then bring it over to the U.S. But I'm not sure. Do you know? That'd be interesting to me to know how the show is doing.
Well, last time I got Rose on, firstly, thank you for going into that. That was interesting. Last time I got Rose on, I think she said something like that they're at that point, where they were considering, is there going to be a second season? Is it going to follow the same storyline, or is it going to be completely different?
I see.
But yeah, I mean, she did say there's hopefully getting it to the States is not too far off.
Oh, great.
Yeah, fingers crossed. And not only that, I think she said about Canada and other places. So
great, great. Yeah. I hope so, because I think it really will present a lot of people talking. Yeah. And OCD is still, although it's much, much better than in the last 20 years, it's been amazing how much the public is aware of OCD and in a more accurate way than ever before. Mm-hmm. Less of a joke and more of a understood as a one way human beings can suffer. And I think that's important. But there's more work to be done in that regard. Everybody knows about, germophobics and people who check their locks and stoves. But this is a kind that isn't so familiar. So, and yet it is a very common manifestation of the OCD problem. So I think it will be important. I'd like to see it come over for that reason. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think, as I told Rose, it was one of the best representations of OCD in a TV show I've ever seen. So, yeah, I think it's already done good things in this country and hopefully for the rest of the world soon. Cool. So, just a real general question now about exposure and response prevention therapy is, you know, you've got a person with OCD sitting in front of you, you're just starting ERP. How do you kind of set that up for them?
Well, I think that's the most important. And at this point in my career, with the clinic as big as it is, my main function these days is not to carry out the therapy to the end, but to meet each person for an initial consultation, try to size up. First of all, get a dialogue going so that they know how they're going to be treated here, which is with dignity and with respect, and let them know we're not better than they are. We just happen to know this sliver of information that, and everybody has something to work on. It's not us, but OCD is known, and we can help individuals very often to overcome some of the, you know, limitations. But so first of all is to depathologize it to some extent, to talk about it as just one of the traps that, and this is my own perspective, having worked with children. Remember at Temple Medical School, I was working with the adolescents and children, and I really enjoyed them very much. And I could see the differences. Every time they came in, it was going to be a lively discussion, and their creativity, they were funny, they would be put me down in the most hilarious ways. So I recognized that an agile mind. Second thing, these were very much emotionally alive kids. The humor abounded, and yet they had a great deal of empathy for other children. They could talk about things. You could see the excitement in every fiber in their being. So it started to occur to me that I didn't think of these kids as having something essentially wrong with them. I saw really some very desirable qualities, just to go over them again, two, and then I'll mention a third. One was this very internal manipulation of symbols, and they were thinking out of the box. Their mind would be all over the place, and that's creativity and inventiveness and you know, a lively mind. Second, they were not cold fish. They were, you could see, passionate about things and excited. But and the third I'll mention in a moment, but that I thought were the raw ingredients for classic OCD to occur. A person had to have a mind that was a bit unfettered and not easy to control, and that made for the ability to be innovative and original and so forth and interesting people. The second was the emotional aliveness. Well, those two connected. Everybody can't access their emotions as well through the cognitive channels. Some people think it's silly that others cry at movies, right? It's, you know, it's Brad Pitt and he didn't die and whatever. And the same thing, when I worked at Temple, I also worked with other issues. And I remember having a group of 10 elevator phobics, and we used a technique called systematic desensitization in those days, was to have people imagining moving closer and closer to their feared activity. Well, out of these 10, only 5 really felt emotions as I had them imagine, you know, in a sort of a little bit of a hypnotic or deeply relaxed setting and monotonous voice. And then you see the elevator down the hallway and you move toward it and you realize you're going to step on it in a few moments. Now some would report that they'd feel stirred up, and desensitization works by, when they get stirred up, you ask them to relax, breathe it away. And then you reintroduce that same thing. And now they're feeling a little less nervous. And then eventually they overcome that nervousness. Now we might have them imagine stepping on the elevator. Well, 4 of them, 5 of them maybe, couldn't do it that way. We had to actually use in vivo desensitization for them. So the difference was, through symbolic channels, at least it appeared to be, only some people are able to arouse their feelings powerfully using just imagination. And so I thought that was a really interesting quality. The other thing I think was essential about the kids was that they tended to be somewhat independent problem solvers. That might have come out of their ability to think about. And that's when OCD, I think, the jaws of the trap spring, is when a person begins to use compulsiveness, which is really avoidance or escape. Right? If a person's afraid of a doorknob and germs on a doorknob, it might be that they avoid touching the doorknob. They'll use their sleeve, or they'll use a tissue. Or if they happen to touch it, or touch a place that somebody else touched it, or a hand of someone who touched the doorknob, then they wash it. That's escape. So they would like to avoid, they have to escape. I point out to people in the that that's the recipe for maintaining and even allowing your discomforts to grow. I say, imagine that if you were a child and your mom, when you cried for being in a dark room, turned on the light, and you convinced her to leave the light on all night long. And if the light fused blue, they had to have a flashlight and come in instantly. Well, how long before you were unafraid of the dark, right? Because you were using avoidance and escape. It's not really good problem solving. It temporarily feels better, but it doesn't solve. And so we know now that exposure, whether it's exposure speaking in public — I was once terribly afraid of speaking in public. Now it's okay. I mean, it's easy for me. But it was only because I was forced to, at some point in my education, to do it against my will. I was a good avoider and escaper, and therefore I held on to my fear of public speaking into graduate school. So, you know, whereas if I worked on it earlier, if I had the exposure experiences, I probably could have gotten over it very early. So anyway, that's how I see OCD. A combination, a little bit different, I know, and my colleagues know that I don't necessarily think of it as something fundamentally wrong with an individual or their chemistry or their brain circuitry. Instead, I think of it as the downside of certain qualities, human qualities that are quite admirable, but that have associated with them a pitfall that some will fall into. And so when we get them out of that and teach them not escape, not avoid, but to engage this and realize that their feelings are going to change, their thinking about it are going to change in the prospect, then we're going to see some real changes in life, because that is what it is to be human, is to experience things on the physiological and emotional level, the cognitive level, and the behavioral level. So we're trying to touch all of those in the therapy.
Yeah. No, thank you. That was really interesting. And similar to that then, so you may not be doing the ERP now, but I'm guessing you still supervise the other clinicians. And what are some of the most common sort of sticking points you find people have with doing exposures?
Well, the sticking points are the usual ones, that that we're always asking people to do things they don't want to do. Yeah. or asking them to do something, to not do something that they're inclined to do, right? And that's tough. Not easy. I mean, just think about it. Anything where, you know, when you have work to do, you don't want to do, easy to avoid it or escape it. So we're facing the same dilemmas that all human beings face, is how do we do the things that feel wrong and bad that we know are better for us, whether it's exercising or eating healthily and or saving our money instead of spending it, right? Or how to do things stop doing things that are not good for us, like eating junk food or spending too much time on the couch, or, you know, whatever. You know, these are major stuff. So I think it's very important to, first of all, to have someone well prepared, and well prepared is to have that initial conversation so that they understand how you're looking at the problem, and showing them that it's not really I always say our work, exposure response prevention, is weird stuff. Let's face it. And the example I sometimes use is my son, when I took him, drove 3 miles to the New Jersey, 3 hours to the New Jersey shore to to experience the ocean. And he first thing he noticed was that there was a jellyfish on the beach. And then some, he talked to some kid who told him, oh, yeah, they sting you. And now he's standing on the shore. He's a little kid standing on the shore saying, I don't want to go in the water. I'm just going to stay on the sand. And like a good psychologist, I said, but I didn't drive 3 hours for you to stay on the shore. We drove for the ocean. Then when I settled down and I realized, I said, well, I tell you what, look, let's watch the kids for a while and see if any of them, you know, look like they've been hurt or stung. And then, no, they look like they're having fun. What if we get our toes in the water? We can see, right? The water's very clear. We can see, you know. And then, of course, my psychology clicked in instead of my evil dad, you know. and sure enough, he loves the show. We still go to that. I'm from Jersey, so Jersey, we have an ocean closer, but we still go up. But if it's, the whole point is that we can understand what we're up to on the basis of just ordinary human experiences. Now, when I said OC exposure, ERP is weird. Imagine if I said to Dave, yeah, Dave, there's not only jellyfish out there. There are sharks out there. That jellyfish can sting you and knock you unconscious. A shark could bite off your arm or you know, we all left is some chop meat out there. Well, that's kind of what we are doing a lot of times with exposure. We're exposing people. Of course, it's not that brutal, and we don't go to the very awfulest things first. But you see what I'm saying? It's not ordinary human way we deal with someone. If a child is afraid of thunder and lightning, we don't flood them, you know, open the windows and make them stick their head out. And we do other things. So exposure and response prevention is only done because evidence shows that ordinary human ways of doing it, comforting people, reassuring them, it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work so well with panic either. So we know now that we have to, and that's why OCD was virtually the last of the neuroses, come back, you know, circle here, of to be solved, because ordinary ways of working with human problems didn't work with it. And so that's where the research that FOA and others at her program, we were all involved in the research at some point, was to discover that yes, that exposure response prevention was necessary, and it had to be done at higher levels than we ordinarily did for phobias and things of that sort, right? Mm-hmm. So it all makes sense, and I think everybody can, even our kids understand that, those things, if you just take time to explain it. And that allows a person to be gradually acclimated to what we're doing and how we're going to do it. And I tell them there's no surprises here. We're not going to trick you. We're not going to force you. We're going to invite you to do things that we think you're ready for, like any coach does. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we're more like coaches and teachers and coaches than we are doctors. We don't fix you. We teach you things that we think will help you fix yourself. And we coach you through using it until you don't need us. Right. And so we still run into problems, but when steps are too big, half steps may be okay. When that's too much, then maybe a quarter step, or maybe move in a slightly different direction to gain confidence and to move and then return again. So that's the art of it, I think, that makes it always a creative endeavor. And why we never get bored, because we're not doing the same thing. Two, you know, three, four, five people have very similar stories, but their therapy may be very different because the nuances of therapy have to match the creativity, the individual creativity of each person. And it's very high in OCD people, right?
Yeah, absolutely. No, thank you. That was really interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting what you said about your son. I think, mm-hmm. It's easy, like with my wife, I'll lose that kind of therapy hat and go into bad husband mode instead of.
Well, you're going to be you're studying to be a therapist, I understand,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And you have a wife?
Yeah.
Do you have a kid?
Not yet, no.
Okay, well, maybe someday. You'll hear the same thing that we hear, and that's that as soon as we try things that work so well with our clients, I remember my son saying, when he was a teenager, a little mouthy, don't pull that psychology crap on me, Dad. You know, when I'm talking about and then the other was we'd use reinforcers, and or I'd suggest, hey, Dave, wouldn't you like to earn a little more for your or that trip you that whatever it was that you asked me for? He'd say, and then I'd penalize him by removing points or something. He would say, why don't you just hit me like other dads do? We were always talking about this stuff. He said, here, just, you know, and I said, well, you know, so it's really funny that we talk about it among ourselves, that it's amazing how well the power we have with the families and the individuals we work with when we go home and we're, you know, not quite as powerful, right?
That's true.
So yeah. That's an aside. It doesn't teach us anything, right, about OCD, but
no, know. But it's a yeah. It's therapists listen to this show as well, so I'm sure they can relate to it. Cool. So you've done some work with Tourette's as well.
If you work with OCD, you're going to see Tourette's in some way, especially kids, especially with kids, but even with adults. And do you want me to talk about that?
Yeah, please. Yeah, absolutely. How it links, etc.
All right. Yeah. Well, the link is very interesting and not quite fully worked out, but they're physiologically, genetically, phenomenologically, meaning how it manifests itself. There's so many similarities and there's converging of so many factors that it's pretty clear that these are related disorders, but it's not entirely clarified how. Well, my perspective on it was that there are so many interesting things that stood out to me because I work with both kids with Tourette's and kids with OCD, that very often they were telling me some of the same things. Now, I'm going to just for a moment back up a bit and say I'm not talking necessarily at this point about classic, what I call classic OCD, which is where there's a cognitive theme like AIDS on a doorknob or, you know, danger in the appliances around my home. I'm talking about the kind that is often called just so OCD. Yeah. And so let's look at that a minute. A person says, all right, I have to, if I tap this side of the armrest, I feel like I have to tap this side of the armrest. If I start off on my left foot, I feel like very uncomfortable, so I start off on my right foot. I have to make square off my turns in a classroom when I walking through the classroom. Or another thing very interesting, you have therapists listening. You might have some people with Tourette's, something I call a string thing that the kids go, wow, how did you know about the string? That, and a lot of kids would tell me they have to walk the same way out around the chairs and things out of the classroom.
I used to do
that. Yeah. So I call it the string thing. It's like a string coming out of your butt that would get tangled if you went the wrong way around the chairs. And they get a kick out of that, you know. Anytime you're in that realm of jokes and poo-poo jokes, you're with them. So I noticed one thing when I asked them, I said, well, what would happen if you didn't do it? Okay, now, when you ask people with classic OCD what would happen, it's often in line with some obsessional theme. Maybe I'd go to hell, God would punish me. Maybe I would catch an awful disease and I would die and people would think I didn't take care of myself. Maybe I would start a fire and I'd be responsible for burning down the house and maybe killing someone the next thing. Maybe that bump in the road, I might have bumped somebody into the off the road and if I didn't go back and look for them, then I might be a hit and run driver and I would feel so guilty. Well, those are classic OCD, the O and the, but these folks, often the kids would say, well, what would happen? I don't know. It just feels like it would feel awful. You know, I couldn't stand it. And so even if I tried not to do it, I'd have to do it because it might go on forever. Or it might, I don't know. It just feels terrible. Now that sounded to me like what the kids say when, why do you blink your eyes? Or why do you grimace when you make your face or move your arms and shoulders? Well, it's a feeling that builds up, and if I don't do it, it feels excruciating. So it's easier just to do it, because if I don't do it, I'm going to suffer and I'm going to have to do it eventually anyway, right? So I said, wow, that sounds an awful lot. And I began to investigate the literature and saw that even seasoned clinicians on both sides of the board, the neurology side, the medical side, the Tourette side, and the OCD, psychological, medical, and so forth, they couldn't even, experts with a lot of experience can't tell the difference between complex tics, which very many of those, they would be often diagnosed, those things diagnosed as complex tics by neurologists. But if they're seen by a psychologist or psychiatrist who's more familiar with OCD, then they call them compulsions. So we're seeing the same things, the evening up, the doing things in a sequence that doesn't make sense. And one is calling them, and so I and my colleague Dave Kuehler here wrote an article, which was very hard to get published because it had no data. It's just a theoretical article where we coined the term Touretic OCD, arguing that this was really more a manifestation of a Touretic underpinning, a nervous system that was more Tourette-like. Now, sometimes tics would actually occur coexisting. Well, that's known. That's tic-related OCD. But we were saying, no, you don't have to see tics. All you have to do is see a phenomenology where, and now I see more and more people talking about sensory motor OCD.
Yeah.
Sensory, where it's like just like a prodromal syndrome, I have to do something, motor, because it's usually some, not always, but usually a motor movement of some sort or some correction of something, following of a rule, and that's where the notion of Touretic OCD. So using that as a starting point, we began to look at the implications of that. What would happen to it over time? Well, if we followed OCD, it moves right through puberty into adulthood if it's not treated. But wait a second. These kids often would, by the time they're late teens, these things would diminish, right? Mm-hmm. And so like tics, more, not like OCD, like tics. All right, so Touretic, that's where the Touretic is. It's not saying they have Tourette's disorder, not saying they have tics. It's saying they have a probably a physiological underpinning and a phenomenological, easy for me to say, right, phenomenological experience that is much more like tics than is like standard. Mm-hmm. All right. So, and usually you see a list of symptoms of OCD and tacked on the end is this just right thing. And it seems not quite like the rest of the stuff. So I wrote that. I wrote another article for the IOCD newsletter. And every year I get hundreds of, from all over the world, people hit on this, Touretic OCD. And I keep trying, don't come here. I'm not worth coming all this way. Find a person who knows both Tourette's and OCD, and show them the articles, because what we say is that some of these things will dissipate with maturation. You don't have to treat every, you know, but some of it can morph into classic OCD. You said you had these experiences early on. I don't know if you still have them. Some people do, but some that disappears. Now, what happens, though? When people get used to responding to an internal distress by doing something that feels good, that's a good model for OCD, because with OCD, in a sense, and there may be a transitional point where a kid is thinking, now he's thinking, why am I doing this? Why do I have to do this? And the kid answer to himself often is because something bad might happen if it doesn't. Now we're starting to get into a cognitive affective mode. If that bad gets identified as maybe mom and dad, something could happen to dad, he's taking a plane flight, maybe my friends won't like me anymore, maybe I'll lose my sense of humor or intelligence. Now it's got it no longer needs that Touretic aspect. And even if that matures out, this other aspect can occur too. Well, that's only one of the implications. That the other is that the toolbox we have for Tourette's says, and tics says, do something competitive with the behavior. With OCD, it's don't do it, right? Response prevention. It doesn't say do something else. Of course, that almost could be implied, but in fact, we don't train someone doing something else usually. But we found with Touretic OCD that rote practice of competitive responses, it might take longer than classic OCD, and it might not seem as certain, but it didn't. So we began to use tools from the Tourette's toolbox to treat these kids who were sent to us because they had OCD, but we thought they have TOCD, and we felt we were getting better with that. And with the medication people we talked to, they usually obviously use an SSRI, Prozac, Luvax, Lexapro. Instead, they say, why don't we try something from the other side of the board, even though they don't have tics, and sometimes they do remember, but something, why don't we try an alpha-2 agonist like clonidine or 10X, let me use the clonidine or guanfacine to try that if the SSRIs just aren't working so well. And in fact, with that variety of OCD, they don't work so well. You can't rely on the SSRIs to have as probable an improvement in that individual, produce a probable improvement as you would in the standard OCD, classic OCD. And these others sometimes work. They're not perfect, like any medication. But you see, we've gradually shaped a different way of different perspective on that type of OCD that leads us to, I think, make decisions clinically more effectively, to help the person understand their experience more thoroughly, and to show parents that there's a way of looking at their child that doesn't require them to. It's a tough road to hoe for these kids, many of them. We call them the alphabet soup kids. Like Tourette's, they tend to have ADHD, sometimes learning disabilities, sometimes oppositional defiant. So they have an array much more like the Tourette's kids, Tourette's plus kids, than standard OCD kids who can be like that a little bit, but not as reliably like that. So again, they seem to fit the Tourette's mold better. I don't want to do any more on that because that might be a small segment of the listening people, and they can look up the articles if they'd like, but I'm very passionate about it. It spurs me on, and I thank the kids for being so patient to teach me things that were not in the book and to shape my approach to becoming a better therapist, I would say.
No, that was fascinating, though. Thank you. I'll definitely have to listen.
Sure. Thank you for listening.
No worries. I have to listen back to that and digest it more. But it does make sense at first listen. Definitely.
I'll send you.
Yeah, please do.
A couple of the articles and
cool.
Brief reads, but there's a lot in there with that I think is worth. You're an expert on this, so what you think is important. You know, parents are experts on this more than doctors are because they watch their kids thousands of hours, and we see them 45 minutes a week. So, yeah.
Yeah, please do, and I can link them in the article as well for anyone interested in reading them.
Okay.
Cool. So next question is a very general one, but I like to ask it, which is just advice for living with uncertainty.
Well, I love that. Okay. Again, everything leads to a story. Remember, I was a professor for 36 years, so I can take off on anything. But my good buddy, you know John Grayson,
yeah.
Don't you? You know
yeah,
John
I do,
Grayson.
Yeah.
Wonderful. And you know John's very probably better known than anybody for the focus on uncertainty, right? Well,
yeah.
We were young guys together at Temple Medical School. We were best of friends. We still are. But we separated after the Temple, and we went our separate ways. Well, we got together professionally very often at the conferences, and we would sit and have a beer and just talk about ideas. And we came to have some very different ideas about some fundamental things. And so I said to John, why don't we do this in front of an audience and see if they would be interested? Because I think a lot of interest, you know, different perspectives on the same idea, you know, same questions. We wound up doing a series of probably 10 different topics in various kind of conferences. They were popular for a while, then we just ended it. We just talked this year about resuming it if anybody's interested. But one of the times we made a very tragic error, we felt. All of them were very compatible. What we would do is take a topic, like what you still not know about OCD that you're dying to know? And we would just riff on it for 45 minutes or an hour and a half sometimes. And we could do that. It would go off into the, and the audience would participate. That would be an example. But one time we decided to do a, debate. The debate was, is acceptance of uncertainty necessary for resolution of OCD? Now, John took the side of course it is. I took the side, no, it isn't. It was scheduled for 8 o'clock in the morning at an IOCDF conference. We thought, well, nobody's coming anyway, so we'll just go and give it a go. Well, turned out all the luminaries that you might expect were there, and they have scorecards. They're all there joking. They're going to keep a scorecard round by round, right? So anyway, we went through this, but what we didn't like was, instead of being friends and compatible, we were scoring points and trying to find the weak spots, and we were both exhausted and said, let's never do that again. And the audience, of course, they were all friends of ours, so the scorecard came out at the end. Okay, we're going to record, and dong, 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 dong. And it turned out, well, Mansueto took the early rounds. John came out strong. It's a draw, and so the point was that I've always said to John, I love the way you think, but all that uncertainty talk hurts my head. I think I tend to be a little more B than C, and I do feel, although I understand the research that suggests that perhaps it's not pivotal, that it's really important to change the emotional reaction at some point, right? That it is part of it. It may not be everything. I know about cognitive shifts and ability to function in spite of the discomfort. Keep up with the literature. But I use a model in my head, is that what we're going to do is like staying in the dark. We're going to eventually make it possible for you to do the things that are now very, very difficult more comfortably. And of course, initially we're helping them do it in spite of their discomfort. But eventually, I think a fundamental, real, deep felt change does require an emotional shift. So there's where it's a little bit different. How much is cognitive? How much is emotional? But of course, we're one mush, and it's a little bit of a lot of things, probably some we don't even know about. Anyway, that's where I am. So I'm not, people can probably sit with me for hours and the word uncertainty won't come up. Doesn't that sound odd after you've focused on it, or maybe even come to think of things through that lens of uncertainty? So I'm not, of course, I'll talk about it, and it does tend to come up in one way or another.
Yeah.
But for me, it's not a pivotal point nor an essential teaching element within the therapy we do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, that makes sense. And yeah, thank you for going into that. Mm-hmm. I'll have to share this episode with John.
Yeah, he'll listen to it, and we'll have another debate.
Yeah,
maybe. He's feisty. He loves a good fight.
Yeah. I could get you both on, and you could have it out on the podcast.
All right. Yeah, it'll be a cage fight. Only one comes out alive.
Cool. So, what's one thing that you notice from your clients that seem to recover quicker than other clients?
Yeah. Well, back to the varieties of OCD. Some OCD is deeply emotionally felt, that I'm scared to death of whatever that is. I'm scared to death to do this or not do this or whatever. Take the doorknob again. Easy example. Touching it, touching my mouth, eating a cookie without washing. Are you kidding? I'd rather walk through fire. So that's the how we usually think about it. One of the things, though, that I do see is that there are varieties of ways that beliefs can be strongly held that don't necessarily anymore. Maybe they did at one time, but they no longer. They're more rote. I just don't do that. I don't do that. I don't eat without washing my hands with antibacterial soap, and I wash up to my elbows. There's some that essentially are rule bound, In other words, they're following rules. Now, this is not original thinking. It just simply is noticing that sometimes when we do the assessment, that there may be some things that are not, that are thought of differently within the same person, different elements that might be handled differently. So sometimes, and I'll give you one of the things I did with John Grayson again. John, if you're out there, you know, tip of my hat to you. You're a great guy. But one of them was, we called it Impossible Cases, Miracle Cures, right? And what we were going to do is present the ones where we can't fathom how these people got so well so quickly. You know, we just, what we did, we don't understand how that brought them to where we were. And why did I mention that? Because I was thinking of a particular case. Oh, a case where a fellow, he was a salesman, and he had also religious beliefs, and he knew where in Washington cathedrals were and major Catholic university and so on. And he wound up, he had different ways that he could go because they felt holy, and other ways that felt like it might be devil influence, right? So we did all of this, and he had been crippled as a salesman. Eventually, there were too many associations he made, and now the names of the streets could be, if they reminded him, you know how this can work in a very creative mind with strong feelings and a horrible thing hanging over their head, hell, you know, which is a scary idea, you know. So anyway, he also told me a few other things. He said, I also, and one of them, the one I remember, and you'll know why, is he said, and I never take the first thing off a shelf. I always go behind it. And I said, is there a special number? Like, you know, some people, the Trinity, so three might be good, or always, you know. No. It could be the second, could be third, doesn't matter. I said, huh. And I said, what's this? Has that tie in with, would you go to hell if you, no, I just can't do it. You know, I can't do it. So I said, you sure you can't do it? I said, there's a 7-Eleven right across the street. You know, I said, when you get out of here, why don't you go to that 7-Eleven and buy yourself a soda? I said, it's on me. Here's a buck. And take the second or third one. Would you give it a try? You know? So, and I said, give me a call. How did it work out? And he went over, and I didn't hear from him. And pretty soon I had somebody come in, and an hour went by, 2 hours went by. I said, oh, my gosh, you know, I hope nothing, you know, major happened, because I hadn't planned it really well. It just it was a sort of an instinctive thing. So then I get a call about 3 hours later. He said, Doc, you'll never guess where I am. He said, I just drove past, and he told me he drove past the cathedral, Catholic University, went in all the wrong directions. He said, it was like the spell book got broken. And I said, wow, you know, that was kind of amazing, right? Well, it is amazing. We don't get that kind of thing very much. I mean, there were only a few cases we could each relate, impossible cases, magical cures, or whatever it was. But that was one. That was one where couldn't quite get why that happened. Now, I think he broke a rule. And before that, yes, he could justify it, but perhaps he found out that that fear was not there, you know, that fear was not there. Now, you might be able to interpret that in many different ways, maybe with I'm sure John would have uncertainty in there, too. But what to me, it was what happens sometimes when it's not an emotionally based, but perhaps a you know, some practice rule that one has been reluctant to break and associated with something, but doesn't have a strong emotional connection anymore between the two. So then it becomes a matter of breaking that rule. And that was one of the cases. I did a few others. And at least two of the cases I presented were of a similar sort, where I asked them to do something that was relatively simple on their hierarchy, but similar in its manifestation. And when they did the simple thing, all of a sudden, on the other side of it, wow, a bunch of stuff just crashed to the ground, that hierarchy, boom. And now they were freed up, and neither of those people I presented, and a couple of others, needed much therapy after that. It was just to ensure that they continued to break the rules, to go against those rules, to get more comfortable until they, not long, they didn't even think about it anymore. At least one of them that I still stay in touch with. So that's the answer about, I don't know what the question was anymore,
No, it was
but
just,
it was a stimulating question, and I enjoyed answering it. I hope I answered in some way whatever you asked.
yeah, you did. No, that's a really, really interesting story. So another general question. So just like words of hope, I guess, for people with OCD.
Well, I think people have. Now, there are again very many varieties of OCD and a lot of different stories. And when we, as you can imagine, when we practice bad quote, I'm putting those what, air
Air
quotes
quotes,
around
yeah.
it, bad habits for a long time, very well might be harder to break those habits. And so there are channels in the brain that I think we can make connections that become kind of a superhighway. And in many ways, we're probably trying to create an off ramp and a path that then we can substitute and eventually will be used and become the dominant way, the non-OCD way of functioning in those presence of the kind of cues that the superhighway, striatum or whatever want to call it. But we know about learning. We know about this technology. We crack the code, and yes, and everybody doesn't have the experience that they would prefer as far as how far they've gotten, or even in the success of their treatment. I think that there is still a matter of luck. I always tell our trainees, everybody's cup of tea. I know I'm not everybody's idea of what an OCD psychologist is going to be like. So I might not be. I might remind someone the Uncle Henry that they always hated. I can't help that, And maybe some other things. Maybe they don't like my New York accent or something. But whatever it is, that some of it's luck of the draw. And I would say to people that our techniques are powerful, that sometimes we're not ready for something or the chemistry wasn't right, and don't be disillusioned or lose all hope because of experiences that weren't quite positive enough. That at another time, with another person, with a fresh start, a new look, there can be very different, great differences. So it's not, I don't think that it didn't work. It's learning. Learning works. And I don't think all OCD is the same. So I think that sometimes we're going to learn more about things to make this learning experience that we call therapy even better than it is now. There's no doubt in my mind. And of course, we're always hoping for a drug or a ray gun or something that makes our work no longer necessary. An operation, whatever, a stimulation, a beam. I'd go back to elevator phobics again. They're around. I have lots of work to do. I'd love to see a cure. But right now, there's no despair. I've seen in my lifetime a tremendous amount of research, tremendous amount of hope. And I would like to just communicate that to others that we're big enough that sometimes when we run into a log jam with our client, we say, you know what? I think I'd like to have you have a fresh look with one of my colleagues here. And often that breaks up the log jam. Also, we work as teams, and we much of our time during the week is pooling our knowledge because none of us has the corner on wisdom. We tend to think in certain tracks and fall back on old habits, even as therapists. So I do believe that novelty and fresh approaches and a fresh start, for many reasons, maybe what's necessary when the therapy hasn't been as successful as possible, but never give up because there is a potential, I believe, for everyone to improve to the point that their life can be a much better place.
Yeah, good answer and really good points. Okay, so let's say you had a time traveling phone and you could pick up that phone and call your 20-year-old self. What would you tell him?
at 20, I was fascinated by OCD, and my wife might say, you know, once in a while, you know, or when she's really mad at me, she might say, well, it takes one to cure one. Mm. You know, when we all have some O's, you know, things we're a little too thoughtful about and concerned about, and we all have C's, things that we feel, you know, we like to do a certain way, our idiosyncratic habits. So we all have that. It's very human. The D is the problem. When those things take hold and now cause disruption of our happiness, our productivity, you know. So my 20-year-old self would say, stick with it. You're going to have a great life if you don't get distracted away from OCD. That's clearly what I would say at that point, because even then I was still already fascinated as an undergraduate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, awesome. And then next one is, you've got a billboard in Washington. What do you want written on that billboard?
Wow. With the OCD thing in mind, we love you. You have OCD, we love you. It's because people feel very damaged, and often their lives are so. But, you know, even everybody isn't always easy to deal with. Obviously, the tougher ones, but there's something so poignant about OCD. It seems to me such a fundamentally human problem, and problem of people that I like being with anyway. You know, the thoughtful ones, the emotional ones, the independent ones. So I like to see the qualities through the OCD, and that I wish everybody. I hope everybody sees that too. I've told parents that if we took away everything that made up your child's OCD, you wouldn't have a child, the same child. And you wouldn't, I don't think, value that child like you do this child. That sense of humor, that creativity, that feistiness, that willingness to be the odd one in the group. I said, that's part of the OCD, you know? The OCD is the downside. So what we want to do is give your child the owner's manual for that particular and really fine set of qualities that has gone awry. In that one of the articles on TOCD, I point out that I like to say to the boys, it's like you're driving a Ferrari and everybody else is driving a Toyota. Well, you've got the best machine on the road. You could get in trouble with that thing. The cops are watching for you. And you're in traffic, you step on that accelerator, you're in the back of the back seat of that Toyota in front of you. But if you and going around a curve, you hit a little gravel, you're off into the trees because you're doing 80 and it feels like 40. But you're driving a wonderful machine. When you know how to handle that, then you are really king of the road, right? Mm. And that's what we're doing. We're trying to give the kids. Okay, now I should say, my colleague said, that's awful macho. And I said, and sexist. And I said, yeah, it is, I guess. So, but being a little sexist and old school, I came up with a slightly different metaphor for the girls. I say, it's like you're a thoroughbred. And yeah, there's a bunch of old Nellies around. And somebody wants a nice ride around the farm, better take the old Nellies. Because a thoroughbred, although fast and beautiful in motion, they're not easy to manage. You know, a bee comes out and this horse is, you know, you ever watch them try to get a horse in a starting gate and they're jumping all around? It's not easy to handle. But when you know how to handle that beautiful creature, boy, there's nothing else on earth like it, you know? And so we have to teach you how to handle that beautiful creature. Yeah. And so, you know, that's about the teretic nervous system to tell and little kids. I remember once, more than one actually, saying, you have a lot of magazines out there. Any of them with Ferraris in them? Well, we got some car magazines, put some Ferraris around. And so it was, but parents look at their children in a different way. They say, boy, he is alive. He is always in motion. He's so creative. You know, he's the one that his brothers look to, like when they're bored, you know, what are we going to do? And in cardboard box and a few sticks, and they've got a world around them. So I really believe this. So you could tell that. This way I think about it. And it's a different, I think, something that helps me help people better to appreciate the qualities that may be also found within that cluster of variables we call OCD, but that just needs sorting out, used in a slightly different way, and get rid of the parts that are causing the problems, you know, and keep what is of value.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, really, really good answer and good points. I completely agree. So is there anything else that I haven't asked you that you wish you could have shared today?
No, the other passion, we mentioned it when we talk privately. I'm involved with one thing about OCD, it's spinoff. Pretty soon you're working with Tourette's and you're working with some spectrum kids and you're working. Well, we began very early in NIMH and the work with NIMH, working with hair pulling and skin picking, trichotillomania and excoriation disorder. And I'm the head of the training for nationwide and soon international. We're going to Mexico City to train people in a therapy we developed here. We call it COMB. Treatment, comprehensive behavioral treatment, and that's another passion of mine. So when I'm not talking about OCD, but it's all you know, within the same ballpark, and that's something else we do. So we're a bit behind. Trick and OCD. Trick has been on the coattails of OCD. So if you go in the general public, you probably would find fewer people who are aware that hair pulling or picking at skin is a real problem, that it can change life and destroy lives, and that there are treatments that are very effective. But if you don't know about it or don't know other people do these things and they hide it well, right? Everybody hides it well, then you don't even know to go for help. So that's another one of my missions, I suppose, is to let as many people know as possible that these are common, very common disorders, that they're well hidden, so nobody knows about them, and even doctors and other therapists are not familiar with them, and they often give poor advice or wrong advice. So that's something I'll just mention. If there's anybody listening who's interested in trichotillomania or excoriation, hair pulling, skin picking, then you know, we do training for that. I'm involved with the national organization, TLC, the Foundation for Body Focused Repetitive Behaviors. So thank you for letting me mention that. I know that's not a...
No, that's okay. What's the name of the book you've got coming out for it?
All right. It's a mouthful. It's not like War and Peace, you know? So I actually have the last version. It's New Harbinger, which is a nice one. It's coming out this year, but it's called Overcoming Body-Focused Repetitive Behaviors, a Comprehensive Behavioral Program for Hair Pearling and Skin Picking. Mm-hmm. And I wrote it. I'm the first author, and Sherry Vavracek, my colleague, and Ruth Gollum, those are the three that we gave the first national symposium on trichotillomania. That's one only good thing about – one of the few good things about getting up there is that we were now called pioneers in this field. So and that's another area that I just love to work in and try to help folks with.
Yeah. Cool.
Well, but thank you for asking about that.
No worries. And obviously anyone affected by that, then check out the book. Cool. I just want to thank you for your time and for sharing so generously your wisdom. Appreciate it.
It's more than a pleasure. I know I've listened to some of the other podcasts. I think you're doing a great job. And as you see, this is once I'm reluctant sometimes to get going, but when I get going, I'm hard to stop. So thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
So thanks again to Charles. And if the podcast has helped you or any episode, it would mean the world to me if you could leave a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to the podcast, as it helps me reach more people. So thank you very much. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It's not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.